HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 200, recorded live Friday, February 12, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik R80 Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with developer John Skeet.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. In fact, it is episode 200 of Hansel Minutes, so it may be a little bit more than just another episode. And I thought about, who should I have on this episode? I said, maybe I should get Bill Gates or Ray Ozzie. And in fact, I realized the person that I wanted most to have on my 200th show, representing nearly 4 years of weekly podcasts, was the Chuck Norris of programming, John Skeet himself. And he is on the phone with us now from England. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you very much. How are you?
I am very well. I'm thrilled to meet you over the phone here. People believe that you are, in fact, the Chuck Norris of programming, and this has been kind of a controversial thing over on the on Stack Overflow. About a year and a half ago, someone opened a question about facts about John Skeet and Chuck Norris. Can you give us a little background about what exactly happened and why it was a little mini controversy?
Basically, it was a bit of fun. So I'd been on Stack Overflow for a few months and had risen reasonably quickly due to having just enough knowledge to be dangerous and fairly fast typing fingers. And someone opened this question saying, John Skeet facts, which was clearly not programming related, and various people disliked the idea of celebrating the cult of John, etc., which I can completely sympathize with. But then Jeff Atwood, who started Stack Overflow, weighed in and said, no, Stack Overflow is about the users, so this question's fine. And it's been open and then closed however many times, loads of times. But at the same time, it's got hundreds of answers. It's extremely silly, to be honest. It's not about me at all. It's about, let's see what silly things we can come up with that a superhero programmer would have.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah, it's not about John Skeet, who we're talking to. It's about the mythical beast of John Skeet that we have never met. If you don't mind, I'm going to read a few of these because they're truly amazing. John Skeet is immutable. If something's going to change, it's going to have to be the rest of the universe. John Skeet's code doesn't follow a coding convention. It is the coding convention. And here's the best one, I think, that is the most Stack Overflow-ish. Users don't mark John Skeet's answers as accepted. The universe accepts them out of a sense of truth and justice. I think that's pretty fantastic. There's 279 answers on that question. It continues to go on and has a life of itself. But you are very well respected as a technologist, and you work for Google.
I do indeed.
But have written C# in depth, which is out now.
Yeah. So I work for Google in the London office on the mobile team, which means I write Java most of the time. And I should point out that I don't speak for Google in any way, shape, or form, so don't regard anything that comes out of my mouth as the voice of Google. But yeah, so I write in Java, I write about C#, I mostly program C# for fun. I find it a lovely language to work in. C# in depth has been out for about a year and a half now. Ironically, it actually was published about the same time that I came over to the States for a fortnight for Noodler orientation, as they call it. So just as I was officially leaving a career in C#, the book came out, and by the time I got back, there was a lovely carton with my 25 free copies. But the C# in depth second edition is what I'm working on at the moment, and that will come out probably June, maybe July.
Did you have a problem moving from C# to Java, or was it more about working for Google, regardless of the language that you'd be using there?
Well, I certainly decided to work for Google, whatever the language. It's a fabulous place to work. I haven't had very much problem going to Java because I've always been flitting between the two. So I started off in Java. Well, my career started 94, 95, sort of, in university vacations working for Digital. And I started off in Java. That was back in Java 1.0 when it was completely interpreted. So it was a really slow beast back then. And then my first job started off in Java, and I did a fair amount of C-sharp just near the end. Then I went to a job that I thought would be about C-sharp, and it ended up being in Java after a while. Then I went back to another job at C-sharp. Now I'm at Google that's doing Java, although I do 20% projects while I'm at Google in C-sharp where I can.
Are these two languages really that close that someone can move back and forth between them with apparently no major problem, or is this just that you're a good programmer?
Oh, certainly not the latter. I wonder whether actually the problem might be that they're too close to be comfortable rather than too far apart. I mean, people use different languages all the time. There are some people who will write, you know, a bit of JavaScript and then a bit of Haskell, or crazily far apart things. If you're doing some enterprise integration, you might have to maintain some COBOL system and then write some C-sharp or whatever. The frustrating thing sometimes is that Java and C-sharp are very similar in many ways, but Java's just been evolving that much slower than C-sharp. So I reckoned that when C-sharp originally came out, it was a little bit better than Java. And Java was at, I think, 1.4 at that stage. It hadn't yet got generics. So Java got its version of generics before C-sharp did. And you would have thought they would be sort of leapfrogging over each other all the time, but Java really hasn't gone very far in terms of the language since then. We're sort of pinning our hopes on Java 7 to really get a lot of the features that C-sharp already has, and maybe a few other ones as well. But yeah, C-sharp has just been taking off incredibly fast.
It does seem to be kind of a thumb war between the two languages. How many more features can we add to a language? I think that Link is pretty extraordinary, the way that it was added to C-sharp. You know, is there something coming down the line in Java that's going to be, you know, Linky, or in the sense of adding a huge DSL to this language?
I don't know of anything quite on the scale of Link, and I suspect that if that does come, it would be a little bit later. And the main talking point about Java 7, certainly from my point of view, is whether Java will get closures. And it was announced a few months ago that it now looks like it will. For a while, it was no one can work out what closures should look like in Java. So something equivalent to lambda expressions in C-sharp. And there's now a proposal which looks pretty promising, and we'll see whether it happens, but it's meant to happen. And that, for me, is a huge point, because there are lots of things that are like Link. If you imagine that Link query expressions didn't exist in C-sharp, but we still had extension methods, and we still had lambda expressions, and we still had all the type inference improvements that came in C-sharp 3, you could still be pretty darn productive with that. You know, query expressions are icing on the cake in a way. So I don't know for sure whether Java 7 looks like it's going to get extension methods or something similar. I mean, everything can be slightly different but achieve the same kind of thing. But just having closures will make a lot of things much, much better.
What do you use from an OS and IDE perspective while you're at work at Google versus what do you code C-sharp in at home?
So if I'm using C-sharp at home, I'll use Visual Studio either 2008 or 2010. I've just moved to the release candidate of 2010, and it's looking lovely. At work, I use Eclipse for Java, and often, in fact, for both languages, I'll use just the plain text editor, particularly for questions on Stack Overflow. I tend to like to write a small console app, you know, 15 lines long. I've got a test.java and a test.cs in the directory that a console brings me up in. So all I've got to do is edit that, run the command line compiler, and I'm away. And that's considerably quicker than bring up Visual Studio, find a sandbox project, try to get rid of whatever you had before. You know, firing up a very quick sort of Emacs-like text editor is considerably quicker.
Yeah, for that, I've been using a program called Snippet Compiler. It's basically like Notepad, but it compiles. So it does exactly what you just described. You know, you may do a quick little edit, and you go CSC at the command line. But I understand that you definitely don't want to litter the world with, file new console application 96 if you're just trying to do a repro. So what is the OS you're using though at Google?
We use Linux. well, I use Linux as my main desktop, and most people do, most engineers do. I do also have a Windows laptop.
Mm-hmm. Is it okay to ask which distribution?
I don't know whether it's okay to ask or not, so I'm going to not say anything.
All right. But it is Eclipse, and that's... So you've been using Visual Studio 2010 RC. This is the one that we just released to the public a couple of days ago, and we released to MSDN subscribers a little bit before that. I just installed it on three different machines, fast, medium, and slow, and I'm going to try doing some tests. What kind of machine are you running on it, and how's it working out for you?
So I have a couple of years old Dell Inspiron 1720, which has got, I think, 2 gigahertz Pentium dual core for my main laptop at home. And I've also got a Samsung NC10 with an Atom processor, which I use because I've got about an hour-long commute each way, or an hour and a half in the evening. I tend to try to get some work done on the train. So I've been writing the book and writing some code for the book on the train. So that really sort of puts Visual Studio through its paces in terms of speed. The Beta 2 was not a pleasant experience on a netbook. But with the release candidate, it's actually pretty reasonable.
Hmm. Yeah, the general sense of is that the RC has a huge number of performance improvements. I'm going to be really interested to dig into it and find out if that's something that's specific to the IDE that they made faster, or if it's underlying things like making WPF faster or making other libraries faster in order to enable the IDE to be faster. As I think that if someone at Microsoft has learned a great deal about speed, the rest of us should learn about it as well, take advantage of that.
Yes, it's difficult to know exactly which bits will be due to Visual Studio itself. I know Rico Mariani has blogged about things that they have found whilst tuning the heck out of Visual Studio, and some of those would be quite specific, where it's interoperating with COM or whatever in plugins that most programmers probably don't do very, very much COM integration. I sort of personally hope not, because I don't particularly enjoy using COM myself. But other things I will be interested, there are a couple of strange performance quirks that I found with nullable types, for instance, that would be really kind of deep in the CLR. And I have no idea whether any of that's changed between Beta 2 and the release candidate. But yeah, I don't have, unfortunately, a good performance benchmark other than potentially my protocol buffers, the 20% project that I mentioned earlier on, which is a sort of serialization and deserialization framework. I do occasionally run performance benchmarks with that, so I can see whether that's any faster under .NET 4 than .NET 3.5 now.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman from another parallel universe. Got to tell you about some of our things our sponsors are doing. They make this free podcast possible. If you're developing a new line of business application, you've probably tried the latest version of Silverlight. Now you can get even better results by combining the functionality in Silverlight 4 beta with some of the richness of the third-party controls from our friends at Telerik. They're the first vendors to offer native support for the Silverlight 4 beta and their RAD controls. They've got a new Silverlight 4 CTP suite of these controls. They let you tap into the framework's great potential. You get native right mouse click and all the new features of Silverlight. There's 38 controls that give you all these features. You can start building those compelling line of business applications right away. I encourage you to check those products out at Telerik.com/Silverlight. And, thank Telerik for supporting .NET Rocks, supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page at Facebook.com/Telerik. Now back to the show.
Now, is this new, this framework that you're working on, is that the Noda Time, the open source date time library that you're working on, or is that something else?
That's something else. So Noda Time is a completely personal project. It's got sort of nothing to do with Google, as it were, whereas Protocol Buffers is a Google framework for serialization that I've effectively just ported from the Java. Again, they're both Java ports, really. But the idea of Protocol Buffers is you can have a common portable serialization framework so that someone could send my framework an object serialized from Python or from Perl. I think there's a Perl implementation, or certainly C++ and Java, and I can interoperate with that, send them something back. So it's a lot less brittle than the sort of Java and C# serialization, binary serialization that is very, very specific to that platform. Obviously, it becomes less flexible at that point as well. So you have to specify your serialization messages made out of various sort of primitives. Here's a string, here's a binary blob, here's an integer, etc. So you do have to design your types around that. But equally, you suddenly get portability. It's designed because obviously at Google we have lots of different versions of bits of code running. You can't upgrade all of Google servers to the same version just like that. So you have to have a lot of tolerance for, well, this was a message version 2. Can we read it from version 3? Yes, we can. If we send a message from version 3 back to version 2, can we read that? Yes, we can. It's specifically designed for that sort of thing. Whereas LoaderTime is a completely different project that I really started after talking at the Stack Overflow's Dev Days conference. I gave a fairly light-hearted talk called Humanity Epic Fail, where I described some of the problems that really we brought upon ourselves in terms of computing. So you would have thought three of the things that should be easy, dealing with text, dealing with numbers, and dealing with dates and times. Those are all sort of run-of-the-mill things that we should make fairly easy, but all of them are insanely difficult. And one of the problems in .NET is, while the BCL has certainly been improving, and time zone info and date time offset are very, very welcome, they don't really span everything that I think should be in a date and time library. And there's a fabulous library by a chap called Stephen Colborne in Java called JodaTime. And that is widely regarded as the library that you use if you're going to use date and time stuff on Java. You don't bother with Java util date. You don't bother with Java util calendar. They're too error prone, too difficult to use. No, you use JodaTime. So it seemed to make sense to me to port that to .NET and try to do a really good job of making it feel like it's a .NET library. It's not just a port. And at the same time, because it's an interesting open source project, I thought it would be a good idea to try to take a record of the problems that I faced when porting it, the problems in terms of what does .NET have in the way of build systems, unit test systems, etc. How do you choose one for an open source project? So I'm going to try to pull all that together as a sort of guide to, so you think you want to start an open source project, here are the things to think about.
That's a great idea. Is this something that we can watch? Is there a GitHub or a Subversion repository that we can kind of snoop in on?
There's a Mercurial repository at code.google.com/p/NodaTime. We can put the link in the show notes. We've got loads of people interested. So I tweeted about it and blogged about it at the time. And last time I looked, I think there were sort of 80 or 90 people who were interested in it. Interested enough to have chipped in on the mailing list, and various other committers have definitely contributed plenty of code. It's far from a one-man project. Unfortunately, everyone's busy. I'm busy writing the book, etc. So I started it in September, and my aim was to have something that could be useful and you wouldn't feel worried about looking at and using in a real project in 1 year's time from that September. So I've still got about 7 months to make it production ready. We've got some useful stuff already, but it's definitely early days, and I'm hoping that as soon as I finish C# in-depth second edition, I can start to put some real time into NodaTime.
Will it be as complete as JodaTime? I mean, JodaTime is not just complete, it's like encyclopedic. It supports like 6 different kinds of other calendars. It's not just the standard Gregorian calendars, but it goes out to Islamic calendars, Coptic calendars. Plus, it has a really interesting kind of a Fluent API. Are you going to have similar functionality?
Certainly. So we'll definitely support various different calendar types. We're restricting some of it because in some ways, JodaTime is a bit too flexible. It allows you to create your own calendar fields. So if you had some idea of a third of a week, which third of the week are we in at the moment? You could add that as your own field type in JodaTime, and if you hooked it into every single spot that you needed to, then you could start asking what third of the week today is, etc. Now, we thought that was a little bit too flexible, just in terms of it made the interface harder to understand, harder to implement, etc. So we've tried to simplify a bit. We will have a Fluent interface in the same places that JODA time does, although actually there's a lot to be gained from the fact that we've got operator overloading in .NET. So JODA time tries to stick to immutable types in most places, and in fact, where they do have mutable types, so far we've managed to mostly remove them from NODA time. And immutable types are ideal for operators, you know, adding a period to an instant, whatever. And so that's, it's really trying to take the benefits of all the stuff that you can do in .NET that you'd like to be able to do in Java, but it just doesn't quite support it. And likewise, in Java, they're all reference types. They're all classes because that's all you can specify. Whereas I don't really find myself writing custom structs in C#. But in fact, we've already got three different structs, which are just wrappers around a single long. But they're really, really useful to have as different wrappers. And in fact, we've got one slightly strange scenario. The offset of a date time from UTC. So for a time zone, it's got a particular offset at a particular time. And we've got the strange situation that you can only add it to a UTC time, and you can only subtract it from a local time to get back to a UTC time. So we've got this sort of asymmetric situation, which actually helps you keep type safe. You can't accidentally use it the wrong way around and end up with your offset going backwards, which is strange, but has worked wonderfully well.
Wow. Are you going to deal with time zones?
Oh, yes. So we've got time zone support. One of the things that's missing, as far as I'm aware, from the .NET BCL is support for what's called the Olsen database of time zones. So time zone info has all the Windows names for time zones, which is entirely reasonable given .NET's, you know, Windows nature. But a lot of the rest of the world uses Olsen identifiers. So Europe/London, for example, is the time zone that I'm in at the moment. And we support that. We also support historical changes to the time zone. So time zones are changing all the time. One example I had in November when I was giving the Stack Overflow talk was one of my unit tests had just broken, thinking that Greenland was in Argentina because the Argentine government had just announced that they were stopping daylight savings, and they gave, I think, 11 days notice that they were doing this, which is kind of a mess as far as the software in Argentina is concerned. But it does mean you need to have the idea of a time zone that changes over time. So we can accurately represent what's happened in history, and we can accurately represent what it looks like will happen in the future. And as this is updated, so there's a whole blog to do with dates and time zones changing. And as things change, then the Olsen database gets updated, and then we'd be able to ship either a new complete version of NODA time or just a sort of supplementary, here's the time zone database bit. So you don't need to change your binary, just the time zone information.
This really seems like it'll be an exercise in unit testing. I mean, date times libraries and date time calculations are only as good as their test coverage.
Absolutely. And it's an ideal thing for unit tests because there's no external input. We don't have to worry about what does it look like on the screen. We don't have to worry about how is it going to react when the user types something in, because they're not typing anything in. It's just the library. It's plain old, put some numbers in, get some numbers out. Are they the right numbers? Now, there are various internationalization issues, so we'll have to make sure that the unit tests either don't assume anything about the culture they're in or specify the culture for formatting, for instance. One of the nice things that we've got that, again, follows JODA time is the idea of you build a formatter that knows what pattern it's using, which means that you don't have to parse it all the time. So every time you call date time .tryParseExact or whatever you're calling, if you've specified a format pattern, then the BCL is having to parse that and say, oh, right, you're expecting some years to start with, then some months, then some days, etc. Now, what a waste of time. You're going to use the same format pattern again and again and again. So we've got the idea of a formatter that has already got that pattern built into it, and then it can just scan through the actual input text, which will change all the time. And hopefully that will be considerably faster than the BCL implementations. We are checking performance against the BCL. I'm expecting that a lot of things will be slower just because we're not spending all our professional lives tuning it in the way that I'm sure the BCL team are. But it'll be interesting to see whether on that specific feature we can actually outperform the BCL. I'm really hoping that we can.
Well, it sounds like if you're willing to put this much effort into improving .NET, that you definitely think that there's a future for .NET.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I really... It's something I think about occasionally. We all talk about the COBOL legacy, but I think there's going to be a huge legacy in the future for all of these platforms. .NET's not going away. Java's not going away. Ruby and Python aren't going away. I really feel for people who graduate in, say, 30 years' time and have all these systems, which by then may be sort of legacy in the same way that COBOL is legacy. You know, will we still be writing new C-sharp code in 30 years' time? Probably not. But there'll be a heck of a lot of code to maintain. So I see a rosy future for .NET itself in the short term, and in the very long term, I'm sure it will still be around to be maintained for a very long time indeed.
That's comforting. as somebody that kind of makes their living on community, that's pretty important to me. Do you spend most of your time on Stack Overflow? Is that what community is to you?
That's where I spend most of the time that I think of as community, yeah. So I do write my own blog, and in some ways I guess you could call writing a book a community activity. It feels solitary for some of the time, although for this second edition I've actually tried to get quite a lot of feedback by asking questions in blog posts saying, hey, how would people feel about ditching this chapter or changing the focus of another chapter and so on. So I've tried to get as much feedback as I can early on in the process. But other than that, yeah, I spend a certain amount of time on Stack Overflow. Yeah. I find that I learn an awful lot just from trying to answer other people's questions. I've done that for as long as I've been programming in Java and C#, certainly.
You're still the number one person on Stack Overflow, right?
Yeah, and I was talking about this over breakfast the other day. It's actually slightly tricky because I'm now sufficiently far ahead. If someone joins Stack Overflow today, and if I stopped posting today, then because I've been posting for nearly a year and a half, it would take them a year and a half if they posted the same amount that I have been doing in order to catch up. Sometimes I wonder whether there ought to be some sort of decay to reputation, but equally that doesn't make sense in other ways. It really depends on what you regard reputation as. Miguel de Acasa was tweeting about this just yesterday saying, there's no chance of beating me. Beating me suggests it's a competition, which I guess it is in some ways, but I think it would do us all good to just regard reputation as kind of happy points.
Well, yeah, but when you have a main page that sorts by happy points, it's pretty...
I maybe think of it as a game, and I'm competitive when I'm gaming, particularly. I play board games quite a lot at lunchtime. So, yes, I certainly play to win when I'm playing games. But at the same time, you can take it too seriously. And it would be utterly pointless to try to game the system to get more reputation points just for the sake of getting more reputation points. At that point, you've really lost the whole nature of why you're on Stack Overflow to start with. If I've answered a question and someone else answers it better and includes everything else that I've already written, then I'll just delete my answer. There's no point in keeping it there just to keep a bit of reputation. The point is ultimately to help people as much as possible. And reputation is a fun game to play along the way, really.
I think for me, the thing that's most significant about the kind of the quote unquote Stack Overflow experience is the idea that reputation enables you to do other things. Not that it's most interesting to be number one, but that it's interesting to have some amount of effort into it, because then you get the ability to moderate and the ability to self-maintain. And that it's not just a bit flipping. You're either a newbie or you've been there. There's a gradient of various things that you can unlock, and those things make the experience better, and then you would continue on, and it's a self-maintaining system.
Yeah, and even when you've unlocked all the sort of special abilities, there are still the badges, and particularly with the tag badges, So when you've had 400 upvotes in a particular tag, then you get a silver badge for that. And if you get 1,000 votes in a particular tag, you get a gold badge for that. I always found it particularly amusing that I was the first person to get a silver badge for Visual Basic, which, you know, isn't a language that I regard myself as particularly fluent in. And yet I got a silver badge for that. In fact, I think I may now, I'm just checking, VB.net. Yes, I now have a gold badge in VB. If you asked me to write some VB, I would completely fail. I would have to, you know, compile some C-sharp code and then decompile it in Reflector or whatever. So it does amuse me. But that's just because most questions that people think are VB questions are actually just .NET questions with a VB accent.
I like that, with a VB accent. Let me ask you this, kind of in closing. How much time are you spending on this, really?
Oh, I couldn't measure it because I use it. I tend to spend idle time doing it. You know, how much of the time do you spend breathing? Not that I'm equating Stack Overflow as breathing for me. I'm not quite that addicted. But, you know, it's just something you do while you're waiting for other things. So if I'm waiting for a compile to happen, whether that's at work or at home, I'll just quickly check. If I'm just taking a mental breather, I will check. And then often, usually even, there aren't any questions for me to have a look at. And if there is, I'll take a quick look at it, maybe answer it for a few minutes, sometimes answer a single question for half an hour or an hour. I have occasionally put in quite a lot of effort. So it's something that I spend a lot of time looking at, but without wasting much of my time, if you see what I mean. I don't think anything else would particularly take its place and make me more productive or more useful to humanity in some other way. But equally, it does take a fair amount of my time, yeah.
Okay, but it's not like you sit down and you think of this as a piece of work that needs to be done. Like, all right, got to pound through the Stack Overflow today. It's more of it's your time filler.
Yes, exactly. So where some people would sort of have a game of solitaire because you've got 3 minutes to fill for whatever reason, you have a game of solitaire or you check Stack text slash dot or whatever, I tend to check Stack Overflow. It's just one place to sink my time.
Well, I'm for one, I'm glad that you're spending time over there because it's a great community and I enjoy reading your very thorough and complete questions and answers.
Yeah, it's fabulous. It really is completely different as community goes to anything else I've seen. So I know it looks a bit like Experts Exchange. There's the whole, it's Experts Exchange without the evil. Without having looked at Experts Exchange myself much, I don't know how evil it really is, but there we go. But even compared with news groups, the reaction time is so fast. So it used to be on news groups, we would say, okay, if you don't hear back within a day, then it's reasonable to, you know, ping and say, you know, have I missed something? Did I not give enough information, etc.? On Stack Overflow, if you haven't heard back within half an hour, then I'd be surprised. Normally, when I've asked questions, and obviously if I'm asking a question, it tends to be fairly contemplative or something about C-sharp 4 that not many people will have gone into a particular corner. But even so, I get answers very, very quickly. It really is an amazing resource. I think it really is changing how people can program.
Absolutely.
And the fact that it's so wide, that it doesn't just focus on .NET, but it doesn't just focus on Java. You know, I've answered Ruby questions. I've seen a question and thought, you know, with a bit of research, I reckon I could work that out. So I've gone ahead, found out what a certain operator does or how something behaves, and I've learned a bit of Ruby. I'm not a Ruby programmer at all. I would never have picked it up if I hadn't seen that question. Obviously, I could have done if I'd gone out of my way. I'm sure there are loads of great Ruby resources. But the fact that Stack Overflow just throws them all together means everyone's got just that bit more incentive to learn something beyond their comfort zone.
Yep, I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, John Skeet, for talking to us today on our 200th show of Hansel Minutes. I really appreciate it a lot.
My pleasure. Great talk to you.
Well, this is show 200, another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.